Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Business Report, our weekly podcast on the global defense and aerospace business, sponsored by Bell Helicopter, a Textron company. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, joining you this week from the Paris Air Show. In Washington last week, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and General Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee as appropriators and authorizers on Capitol Hill entered markup season with very different spending targets. Meanwhile, the world's aerospace and defense contractors descended on the French capital for the biennial Paris Air Show at the historic Le Bourget airfield nearby, and we talked to our expert panel on what to expect. But joining us first to make sense of the week in Washington are Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners and Steve Grundman of the Atlantic Council. Guys, welcome back.
Great to be here, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Happy to be here.
Byron, let me start with you. You put a great note out in the wake of the budget testimony that Defense Secretary Mattis and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Dunford gave. And, you know, they told Congress that the Defense Department needs between 3% and 5% increases in a sustained basis in order to just sort of tread water, much less rebuild the U.S. military, take care of modernization, address readiness challenges. But you're saying that that's highly unlikely. Talk to us a little bit about what you thought about their testimony, what history tells us, and whether they're likely to succeed, and if they don't, what it means.
Well, yes, Vago, that was one of the central messages, you know, from both the secretary and the general in their testimony between the Senate and House Armed Services and Appropriations Defense Subcommittees. And I think, you know, the message basically was, look, we're going to need 3% to 5% annual growth above the rate of inflation over, you know, FY19 through FY23 to kind of, you know, stay where we are and maybe increase marginally our military superiority. That period of sustained growth is really unprecedented historically. If you look at U.S. defense spending, I started with the Green Book, which gives you data from 1948. You've never had that long a sustained growth rate. I suppose I could have gone back to 1938 because I'm sure if I adjusted for inflation, you would have had a, you know, 6-year period of growth along that time period, but that's during a major world war. And
right.
I just think, you know, this remains a cyclical business in constant dollars and the purchasing power of the Department of Defense. And, you know, it kind of raises a couple of questions here. Yes, you know, you might get that type of growth in the first year or two, but there are all sorts of things that can happen along the way. There could be a different outcome in the midterm elections where the GOP might lose control of its majority in the House or Senate. Trump might not get reelected in 2020. There could be a major U.S. recession that again balloons the debt and deficit. And, you know, we're back to talking about austerity. So I just think, you know, kind of if that's the mindset you're going into this, I don't know if I were a company that I'd be thinking about planning along those same lines. I think there are going to be some interesting opportunities. They're going to open up for maybe rethinking that sustainability of that growth rate.
Steve, let me bring you in. I mean, one of the things that's happening is that the authorization committees are going to be marking to $640 billion, and yet the appropriators are going to be marking to something that most people would say is far more realistic number. What's the trade-off here? How are they, you know, first, you know, is that a good idea? And B, what's the casualty if you're going to try to, you know, make all this work?
I think it's certainly risky for the authorizers to appropriate to a level that they know or would have reason to believe will not be funded. Because, as you know, the authorizers are perennially in a race for relevance. There's always the fear that if you got through a year without an authorization bill, that people would realize that, you know, you can run the Department of Defense and the rest of the federal government strictly with appropriations rather than authorizations. So they risk, if they truly do mark to those levels that will not be financed, they risk encouraging the suggestion that the authorization bill is irrelevant. That's certainly one of the risks that they run. I wanted to, if I can just tag on to the headline news about the level of the ramp that these two gentlemen are suggesting and juxtapose it to a business story this week about Boeing, as it was put in the headline, purging 50 executives. So that juxtaposition is interesting to me. It suggests that the defense industry is marking, if you will, to the level of the budget or the indications in the budget request and the indications from Mick Mulvaney, the director of OMB, not to the indications or at least aspirations of the secretary and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
From Boeing's perspective, right, it's the elimination of unnecessary management to streamline the company and make it more efficient is the message, at least.
Sure, and, but if we were in year one of a, you know, historically unprecedented ramp up and the defense industry believed it, they wouldn't be restructuring for leaner times, which is, I think, the subtext of that announcement, in my view.
Yeah, I would add, I think it's not just leaner, it's probably leaner times. It's more competitive times. I mean, I think, you know, that was the message that came from that specific action. I think it was triggered by some contract losses, not necessarily going back to the bomber program, but it says, you know, look, this isn't just going to be a gentle 3-5% growth rate that's going to let all these boats just kind of gently coast down the river and flow with the current. You know, you're going to have to fight to grow in this market. And that was what I took away from that as well. And I would agree with Steve. It was not just, hey, you know, this is a rising budget that's going to lift all boats. You're going to have to fight to grow in this budget.
The other thing before you leave the topic of the budget, Vago, is that if Byron's analysis is correct, and there's every reason to think that it is, this suggests to me that the force structure cannot hold because implicitly, right, they didn't say with that 3-5% ramp, we will grow the force structure. And so the converse of that is also true, that if they don't get a 3-5% growth ramp, that ultimately they're going to have to restructure the military services in order to get the foundation of budget back onto a sustainable basis.
Afghanistan was also making headlines this week, and we saw that President Trump has been devolving greater authority to the Pentagon on military decisions. The commander of the mission in Afghanistan, General Nicholson, has asked for more troops, and the president appears to have granted Secretary Mattis that authority. Talk to us about what the dynamics of this are. What are the budgetary implications? And does this indicate that perhaps there's going to be a significantly greater involvement in Afghanistan, that 4,000 is the appetizer to a higher number?
Right. A story ran last week that Secretary Mattis was going to use that discretion and authority that the president has given him to add 4,000 troops to the Afghan force posture, which, to put in perspective, I believe is at 9,500 today, a contested and controversial number that we all may recall the Obama administration had staked its Afghanistan policy around. I have been watching, or I've been thinking that this administration's choices about what to do in Afghanistan would be a really important indicator of whether the sort of campaign posture, America first, retrenchment to some degree, was actually going to play out in policy. And so, for better and worse, this indication says to me that, somewhat like the strike in Syria, right, this is another dot in the chain of indicators that this is not going to be an administration that is going to fulfill the expectations many, and I think many of his own supporters had, that we were going to not retreat to the borders, but have a much more restrained foreign and defense policy, right? Giving General Mattis the authority to, you know, add 50% roughly of the force posture in a complex, messy, difficult to win conflict in Afghanistan suggests to me that, at least from a foreign and defense posture point of view, this administration may turn out to be a lot more conventional than the indications off of the campaign would suggest.
Byron?
Well, I think, you know, it was pretty apparent from some of the, even the comments last week during hearings, that there's still a lot of questions about, you know, what is it going to take to bring this campaign to a close? And I think that's kind of the broader issue is, you know, you don't have the U.S. public, and frankly, I don't think U.S. leadership has the stomach to send in 80 or 100,000 troops to Afghanistan. So we're back to, you know, is this going to be enough? Will air power and, you know, a couple of thousand additional troops be enough to turn the tide on this campaign, on that 16-year campaign? And I think that is still kind of in the to-be-determined category. I don't know, you know, it will have an impact on the OCO request. You know, I don't think that there was a placeholder for additional troops in the FY18 OCO request, so that's something else that Congress is going to have to wrangle with a bit. But, you know, there are a lot more broader questions about, okay, you know, what do we need to do to kind of bring this to a successful close? And, you know, even just the simple questions about how would you define success that were posed to Secretary of Defense Mattis and General Dunford last week, you know, suggested that maybe Congress is getting a little bit antsy here.
Let me take you guys to two things that we've got to talk about. One is the Justice Department statement or disclosure on Booz Allen Hamilton and what that potentially means for the services industry. Company is a key player in the marketplace. Talk to us a little bit about the action and what impact it's had on the stock and on the sector.
So, Vaga, the background of this is that on June 15th, I believe it was after the close of the market, Booz put out a press release that said they were under civil and criminal investigation by the Department of Justice for cost accounting on U.S. government contracts. That's all we know. Well, I think it's the age-old, you know, fire-ready aim, you know, by investors and traders. You know, there it's a single statement that was put out by Booz Allen. I can understand the fear when something like this pops up. There's very little information. The company really can't comment on it. You can't call up the Department of Justice and say, hey, what's this all about? You know, so a lot of these stocks, you know, Booz obviously was in the crosshairs of this, but there was collateral damage last Friday to some of the other major defense services companies, at least their stock prices, Leidos, SAIC, Mantech. You know, the short answer is obviously we don't know. Maybe some mitigating factors that people ought to be thinking about here is Booz has been doing government contract work, I think, since its founding. I think one of their first contracts was with the Navy in 1940. I'm talking about the, you know, all the predecessor companies. Right. So they're hardly new to this. The second thing that I think might mitigate against this is of kind of a, you know, that the market reaction proved correct is, come on, this company was owned by Carlyle Group. You know, the initial IPO, I guess, was 2010, and they finally exited in 2016. But Carlyle, you know, in terms of their oversight, the due diligence that they would do in any acquisition, and their stewardship, they're intimately familiar with government contracts and contracting. And the third point, maybe Steve can weigh in on this, but it just struck me that it didn't seem to, this didn't appear to involve the Defense Contract Audit Agency. It was a Department of Justice investigation. So it might suggest that this is a federal civil contract, not necessarily a DOD contract. I can't say that with certainty, but that absence of the DCAA from the press release or the statements that went out suggested that it's not kind of in some of the core Booz defense contracts.
And I think you would agree, Byron, we know very little.
Yeah.
Right? This was an announcement which Booz itself made. There's very little to know about it. And the impact that it had, not just on Booz Allen Hamilton stock, but the way it was read through to the rest of the sector suggests to me how fragile. I mean, this could be a nothing burger, so to speak, could be. And yet, you know, look at how fragile those valuations were to very thin news. That strikes me. And there's another aspect to it that comes to mind, and that is the fragility of the TransDigm stock throughout the winter and now into the spring over suggestions that this administration is going to come down hard on the slightest indication of impropriety in a company's participation in the defense markets. I don't know where that fever is running through Wall Street, I think. You can see it in the way TransDigm stock gets beat up over, again, they're not under, quote, investigation, but a short seller has been able to get a fever going on Wall Street over the suggestion that the Trump administration is going to be exceedingly hard on peccadilloes of defense contracting. And this feels to me like a further reflection of that. I'm not sure there's basis for, I don't understand entirely the basis for that thinking, but Byron, help me here. There is a fever going about this posture of this administration toward defense contracting and reaction to the little thin announcement from Booz Allen Hamilton, and the read through across that sector is another indication of it.
I don't know if this is as much a manifestation of concerns about Trump. You know, the other factor, I think there are two factors here, and it may just be the way the market is now structured. You have a lot more growth investors in these defense names. And so anything that might impinge on growth, I think there's going to be higher sensitivity to it. The other thing is, frankly, these days, with so much trading being done algorithmically, you know, there's maybe a backstory here on, you know, the automation of stock trading. And, you know, if something's down on this kind of news, there's no human intervention here. It's just down. And there's a volatility factor that's not being manifest in the broader market, but certainly in some of these individual names that may also be a play here, too.
Isn't it interesting that the automation joblessness rate is hitting analysts on Wall Street as it is people in the heartland? I want to take both of you to the Paris Air Show very quickly. You both are sitting it out, but I'm doing this from Paris, which is always a treat. Talk to us a little bit about what you're expecting to hear out of Paris this week.
I think it'll be interesting to see the tone of the show in the first of them after, you know, the peak or perceptions that the commercial cycle has reached its peak, at least in terms of orders. I think the ebullience that would have characterized even to some degree Farnborough last year, but Paris 2 years ago, I would expect it to be absent. I would expect a different tone to pervade because the order book is not progressively filling up in larger sums year over year.
Well, I think a couple of things. You'd expect to hear good news on the F-35 program. You would expect to hear U.S. government leadership that's over at the show and the contractors themselves, the U.S. contractors, say the U.S. is still a great partner for international defense cooperation and that the U.S. is going to stand behind its alliances. But the other thing I'm really going to be looking for, what kind of statements are going to come out of the French, the Germans, the Swedes, the British about European defense going forward? And are there any more concrete proposals or plans from the EU, you know, from defense programs under the umbrella of the EU, or maybe just kind of a Europe first mentality that might start to emerge here? And that's going to be the most interesting thing for me watching this from the bleacher seats in the East Coast of the United States.
And before we go, quick question on Pat Shanahan. He's going to have his hearing on Tuesday, tomorrow. Tell us a little bit about how you guys think that's going to go.
I think, you know, some of these confirmation hearings are so carefully scripted. I think it's probably more interesting the way the questions are asked as opposed to what the answers are. But I do think, you know, Pat's going to bring a very interesting perspective to this deputy SecDef role, which is, you know, a kind of a commercial business background. He was both Boeing military and Boeing commercial. And if the DoD is really going to get at some of these cost efficiencies and cost savings, it's going to be very intriguing to see how Pat approaches this, how he tackles it.
Yeah, I agree. I think the object of interest in those hearings is what are the markers that senators put down with the deputy secretary in respect to reform.
Guys, thanks very much. We really appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you next week.
You're welcome. Have a great time.
Okay, guys. Cheers.
And joining us for a discussion on what global markets were talking about last week and what they expect from Paris this week are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch and Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London. Guys, nice to have you on.
Vago, hello.
Hey, Vago, great to be here.
Thanks a lot, guys. And Sash, again, my condolences to the loss of life once again in your amazing city in that horrific apartment building fire. And I know that there's going to be a lot more on that, but I just wanted to pass that along. You guys have been having a string of these, and it's really quite sad.
Thank you, Vago.
Start off, very, very big week. We're in Paris, all of us. And, you know, Sash, talk to us about some of the big developments that we saw last week and what all eyes are going to be on this week at Le Bourget.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, actually in the wider fighter world, most interesting thing last week was probably Saab, where they had the first flight of their new Gripen E variant. This has been quite delayed. It's probably about 6 months late, although, you know, let's face it, by the standards of modern aircraft programs, that's pretty much par for the course. But they've flown it now, and they were very intent on debugging a lot of the systems before they did. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of Gripen E in air shows, not this week, but beyond that, and also in export competitions. There were two quite interesting pieces of news associated with the Gripen E first flight this week, and that was that Saab is in, you know, degrees of talks with two export customers, actually for the older Gripen C-D variants, Croatia and Bulgaria. And what you can see here is that Saab is positioning the Gripen family really well below the F-35. They're not trying to compete for F-35 customers in general, although Finland will be a very, very interesting competition because they'll certainly come up against the F-35 there. But Croatia, Bulgaria, these are countries with old Russian aircraft, MiG-21s typically, and Gripen C-D seems to be an absolutely perfect modern aircraft to step into that. The key, I think, for Lockheed is going to be whether they can offer a second-hand F-16 at an acceptable price, both in terms of the unit cost and also in terms of the operating cost. At the moment, Saab seems to be doing very, very well in this replacement market, and it would be, I think, fascinating if we saw Saab having both the Gripen E and the older C-D variants on the production line at the same time. It would really show that they understood there were two separate or pretty separate customer bases and they could supply both of them. I was going to then switch really to Rolls-Royce and their trading statement this week. Rolls has put out a trading statement ahead of the Paris Air Show and it's pretty good. It's pretty positive stuff. No change to their guidance. I think that what is probably most interesting about it is that the company talks about news events, news updates around events such as the Paris Air Show are increasingly expected to reflect a transition from a period of above trend order book growth to one of operational delivery. And what that's saying is don't expect very much in terms of orders next week. And I think that that's actually quite an interesting, probably the most explicit statement of low expectations by some of the civil players for the Paris Air Show. And it'd be interesting to see whether the other engine companies share those views and clearly whether Boeing and Airbus do.
Ron? Point of departure for you, because commercial aerospace is going to be, you know, F-35 will be one of the bells of the ball making its Paris Air Show debut. But we're also going to have a lot of commercial aircraft activity, including with the unveiling of the Boeing 737 MAX 10.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, we'll get an official launch of the MAX 10, right? Because it's obvious now already. There's been enough stuff leaked out regarding launch customers, including guys like Ryan, potentially United, Lion Air. I mean, some of that will be incremental order. Some of that will just be conversions of existing unspecified 737 backlog. But yeah, there'll be an official launch of that. It also appears that we'll learn more about this middle of the market airplane. We like to call it the 7M7, the 797. Mr. Hazy at Air Lease likes to call it the Hazy Liner. But we'll learn more about that, I think, at the show, more so than what I think a lot of people were thinking. We might get a lot more details on that at the show. A couple other things, too. I mean, on a Boeing-specific front, you know, July 1, Boeing starts reporting under a new organization, right? They reorganize, and they're going to have a services unit. And that's the unit that their CEO, Dennis, has said that they'll get to about $50 billion of revenue. At least their goal is $50 billion of revenue in 5 years. I would imagine they'll be talking more about that, how they're going to do that. And then some other stuff, too. I mean, this will be the first Paris where we've got, you know, not just the 737 and the 320 flying around, but in flight tests, the 919 and MC-21. So I would imagine on their respective fronts, they'll be trying to sell some kit at the show. Also, I think this will be a very important show for the geared turbofan. You know, in the investor community, there's been a lot of worry over the delays and some of the fits and starts in that program. My sense is we might learn at the show that things are actually starting to get better there and they're going down the right path. And I think that'll bring a big sigh of relief. So that's a lot of the stuff we're looking for. Maybe one other thing that we might find out some more on is this A321++, you know, is it just sort of a way to distract everybody from the 7M7, or is there something really real there? So that's the stuff I'm looking for.
Just a little anecdote on the Chinese, and it's something I think that we should watch out for. At some stage, the Chinese are going to have to decide whether they're serious with the 919. They'll clearly have a domestic market. They could sell 500 aircraft, might even do more in the domestic market over the next decade, decade and a half. But they're going to have to decide whether they actually want to sell it in international market, if only to show that it's a, you know, it's a real aircraft or not. Farnborough Air Show last year, and actually Paris the year before, the Chinese had very, very limited presence. They had a stand which was minimally manned, so it had great model aircraft and that was about it. And then actually at Paris 2 years ago, they had a chalet booked. You turned up, went to the chalet, and you could see the tumbleweed just, you know, blowing across the inside, and the mail had piled up inside the mailbox. So they didn't actually bother to do that bit of the air show. Now, 2 years ago, they didn't yet have an aircraft flying. They weren't serious about that yet. It's going to be very interesting to see whether they up their game this show or whether still with the 919 only just having started to fly, they feel that they need to take a year or so more before they can credibly go and talk to customers again. But I'm going to go and look for the Comac Chalet first thing Monday morning.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I mean, it's going to be really fascinating to see what they're trying to do. One thing I didn't mention before that I think is also very important, this show will be, in a way, not do or die, but very important for both the E1 and E2 at Embraer. You know, their order activity has been pretty light so far this year. And if they don't rack up some orders at the show now, it looks like their deliveries next year are going to have to, you know, come down relative to this year. So that's one of the things I have an eye on. And then the C series really hasn't done anything in a while. So to see if anything happens there. Also on the Bombardier front, there's been a lot of talk about them doing something in their rail business with somebody else, and then the also, you know, potential JVs in the aerospace business. So maybe we'll find out more on the reorganization, if you will, of Bombardier if that kind of keeps moving along.
And just one other point on the A321++. I think this is a really interesting aircraft. I agree with Ron. It's there to try to erode some of the demand for the 7M7 or the middle market, whatever we call it. Airbus clearly are delighted with the degree to which they've already got a big chunk of the middle of the market, all lowercase, but they'd like to keep it that way. Technologically, the A321++ might be an opportunity for Airbus to do a really significant piece of technology insertion and start looking at the use of cold cure room temperature composites for big parts of the wing. If they do that, that would effectively enable them to use one of the A320 series as a prototype in terms of this emergent technology for the next generation, whatever the new small airliner is, something that we should be looking for middle of the next decade or beyond. So, you know, it may be that Airbus would be quite content with relatively limited demand for 321++, 322, let's say 5-8 a month, but the benefit to them would come from being able to introduce a very, very demanding piece of technology without doing it on a brand new airplane.
Let me add, if I may, we recently published a survey, actually Friday morning, we published a survey where we surveyed a couple hundred airlines. And one of the takeaways from that survey was we asked about interest in, you know, the 7M7 as a small wide body and the A321++ as a bigger narrow body. And what was, it surprised us, maybe it shouldn't, that 40% of the airlines that we surveyed, and we had, you know, 200 airlines respond, said that they would be interested in an A321++, right? So so an airplane that at this point is kind of hearsay, right? I mean, we haven't even seen a sketch of this thing. You've got, you know, 40% of the respondents, at least to our survey, say, hey, you know, we would be interested in that. So, you know, there might really be something there, at least from a demand point.
Yeah. And, you know, the argument that you can use a narrow body for a lot of the long range or the medium range, medium haul flying that's traditionally been done by a wide body, it's potentially very disruptive to the old-fashioned narrow-body, wide-body split of the market.
Yeah. I mean, you're already seeing that across the Atlantic, right, with Norwegian. JetBlue wants to fly, what, A321s. I mean, TAP Portugal flying to the U.S. across the Atlantic in A321s, right? So you're already seeing a bit of a, I don't, is it secular, maybe, right, shift, you know, down-gauging from wide-body to narrow-body on much longer haul routes.
The great thing about having the two of you on is that I have the easiest hosting job on the planet because I just ask you one question and both of you guys play brilliantly off of one another, and I have to say, I arrived here in sunny Paris on a United 757. So for all of you commercial aircraft fans out there, the 707 cross-section is alive and well on transatlantic routes. But a very fast airplane, right? You know, I mean, when you
great
look
wing.
At how long it
takes. It was always a great wing.
Yeah, it's a terrifically fast airplane. And so, you know, you make the trip in about 7 hours. So it's really extraordinary.
There's nothing wrong with being overpowered.
Yes. It is the sports car of large airplanes, even totally loaded. One quick question, though, I have to ask you guys about military aircraft and Sash, just to bring this around and end it sort of where we started. You talked about the Gripen. You know, Rafale, the Dassault guys are still very eager. You know, a couple of years ago, we had a lot of activity on the Rafale, where the French did nail some orders down. Talk to us a little bit about Eurofighter, Rafale. You know, are we going to see any activity on those airplanes, or at this point, are they mature and have really gone through their run, and do these manufacturers need to start looking, right? Because the Dassault guys sort of ruined their successful model of the small, light, single engine, highly capable jet that a lot of countries could use, extremely high reliability rates, but an enormous amount of performance for a fairly affordable price.
You know, and you're just describing the Gripen model now. So basically, Dassault has lost that particular niche to the Gripen. It's, you know, Rafale is a highly capable aircraft, very, very capable aircraft, but it certainly is not small, cheap, hyper-reliable, able to be used by conscripts in the way that Gripen was designed to. So, you know, we've seen that market just move. I think the interesting thing is that there are still pretty significant upgrades that are happening to both Eurofighter and Rafale. The most significant is both are getting AESA radars, E-Scan radars. Typhoon gets its, pretty much the first customers to get it actually will be the Q-80s around about the end of this decade. But then there's a big retrofit program coming through the Typhoon fleet. Rafale has clearly already had some form of ESA radar, but there's a big upgrade for that. The big upgrade I think that might make a difference for Rafale is going to be engines. It's been an underpowered aircraft for some time, and they're finally putting through for the F4 standard aircraft a significant upgrade to the engines. And that could deal with what's arguably been its Achilles heel, particularly with regard to the United Arab Emirates, which is the customer that both companies, both aircraft are really aimed at the moment.
And any runway left, you think, on the Eurofighter at this point?
Yeah, you know, the ESA radar, that, and then add Meteor missiles. missiles, and you've got an astonishingly capable interceptor. And, you know, air superiority is still a core part of air power, and really advanced radar, really advanced missiles, really long-range missiles, and that's what Meteor gives you. And I think that keeps Typhoon incredible militarily, probably through the next decade at least. If it does this change the dynamic for certain customers, may well change the dynamic for the Saudis.
Do you think that ultimately the F-35 still, that countries, even if it's Finland or a bunch of other countries, are going to decide, you know, Germany has asked for a briefing, although there's a question about whether or not that was to vent a little bit of frustration at the Anglo-French alliance on aircraft and wanting in on that. But, you know, is F-35 going to end up getting a lot more orders than anybody thinks at this point?
Not at current prices, quite the opposite. I think what the Germans were looking at it for was not as superiority. It was as a bomber, and particularly a nuclear bomber. I think as far as F-35 is concerned, its Achilles heel at present is price. Purchase price is probably pretty good. Maintenance costs look incredibly high. And some nations are saying they are prohibitive. Some nations are saying we don't know yet, which is actually saying they're embarrassing.
DoD's answer is that we're working down that cost curve as we get more familiar with the airplane, and that its ultimate cost per flying hour will be very similar to, you know, what all the airplanes, a little bit higher because it is a stealthy jet, is at least their point.
It's causing the equivalent of sticker shock for non-US participants at the moment. So, you know, it may be that F-35 is the top-end capability, but for air superiority, there may be a lot of other ways that you can do the job, and particularly because other aircraft can carry big missiles, a lot of them, and a very, very large radar. We'll see. What I think is interesting about Germany isn't looking at F-35 for air superiority. They've got Typhoons. Their Typhoon's going to be in service for probably 25 plus years. What they are looking for a replacement is the replacement for their Tornadoes. And the key role for the Tornadoes is nuclear. It's carrying nuclear weapons around Europe, because Germany is the only other nation besides the US that has got that big core role. They do it with the Tornadoes at the moment. They're going to need a replacement for that capability at some stage. But yeah, I'm sure the Germans also put that request in for F-35 data to put some pressure on the Anglo-French program.
Ron, anything to add on that?
Yeah, there's been some chatter lately, right, that the Spanish are also looking at it. So my expectation at the show, right, I mean, there'll be a full court press with the F-35 into Europe, so we'll see what kind of traction they get. But I agree with Sash. I mean, on the price basis, I mean, the other, that's an issue. However, if you want interoperability with the U.S., it's one way to do it.
Guys, thanks so very much. And next week, we'll be doing the show again from Paris as we do a roundup of the air show. Thanks very much again.
Thanks, Fago. Cheers.
Thanks, Fago.
Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report. That's www.defaeroreport.com, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And check out our extensive coverage of the Paris Air Show, sponsored by L3 Technologies and Leonardo DRS. You can follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report, and on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. And follow me on Twitter at Vago Maradian. Thanks again to Bell Helicopter, a Textron company, for their generous sponsorship. And until we're together again, have a great week.